Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. On this week's show, we've got the future and we've got the past. In our first segment, the new film Tomorrowland leads us into a talk about visions of what may be yet to come. And in our second, we'll consider how we conceive of our past, a place we can actually study, but often choose to invent instead. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. So stick around.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. When does learning begin? Are we at the end of privacy? And what does the road from curiosity to discovery look like? The TED Radio Hour is a journey through fascinating ideas, astonishing inventions, fresh approaches to old problems, and new ways to think and create. Find the TED Radio Hour podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
We're bending time all over the place this week, but before we get started, let's go around the table here in historic Studio 44. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us this week as we tackle this variety of visions is our friend Bob Mondello. Bob, what do you do at NPR?
I review movies for All Things Considered.
Well, Tomorrowland is a new live-action Disney film. It stars Britt Robertson and some guy named George Clooney, of whom you may have heard. It's directed by Brad Bird, who did The Incredibles and Iron Giant. And Bird co-wrote it with Damon Lindelof, who we will come back to, I'm sure. In the film, Robertson plays a young woman who teams up with a kind of mad scientist played by Clooney to meet a threat to the very existence of the world. Mm. Threat played by Hugh Laurie.
And Hugh Laurie as the Apocalypse.
Wearing a silk robe. As
apocalypses do.
Yeah, exactly. Glenn, I'm going to start with you. Talk to me a little bit about you and Tomorrowland.
I was disappointed in how disappointed I was in this film. I really wanted to like it.
I thought you meant you wanted to just feel your disappointment more acutely so you could, you could treasure it.
I got that covered. I couldn't help thinking, or at least wondering, if this film had been animated, if I might like it more, because I think then some of the tonal weirdness might be a little harder to see. Because right now, as it stands, it's the three main actors are delivering three very different performances. You've got Britt Robertson, who is giving you manic Disney Channel sitcom realness. And then you've got George Clooney, who's doing his sort of underplayed, world-weary, gruff guy.
I'm reluctant.
That's my George Clooney impersonation.
It's uncanny. And then you've got Raffi Cassidy, who is, I think, 13 now. She was probably 11 or 12 when she made this film. So much of this film's narrative weight rests on her tiny little shoulders. It asks so much of her, and she's an 11-year-old person, and I don't think she's necessarily up to it. The violence in the film is cartoon violence, which would be okay if it was a cartoon, but it seems really weird to me to see all these bodies being tossed around as much as they are in live action. And finally, it just feels like it hits all these Pixar beats, these very familiar Pixar beats, that just didn't feel right to me in a live action film.
Hmm. Okay. How about you, Bob?
I actually didn't think it was hitting Pixar beats. I thought it was hitting old Disney beats. Mm-hmm. I kept on waiting for Haley Mills to come in. You know, I mean,
I thought about that, too. I thought about, like, Herbie the Love Bug and That Darn Cat and all that kind of stuff.
It feels like one of those pictures they would have made back in the 50s and 60s. It's kind of forward-looking in a retro kind of way. It doesn't do anything with that. And after a very little amount of time in the picture, you realize, oh, there's a message.
Oh, yeah.
And, oh, my God, you are beat over the head with that message for, like, 2 hours. By the end of it, I was just thinking, all right, I'll be optimistic. But it's like, but they shouldn't have to hit you over the head with something like that. There's nothing essentially wrong with the picture except that it champions invention
and imagination,
and it doesn't feel very imaginative. It feels like things that we could have seen 40 years ago.
It's funny that you mention it's reminiscent of these movies like That Darn Cat and The Love Bug. That's one more reason that I like this film on paper more than I liked it in practice. I like everything about this movie on paper. I love Brad Bird. I really, really admire Damon Lindelof and his work. I love that kind of forward-looking in a retro way. Brad Bird's really good at old-looking futuristic iconography. I like so many things about the idea of this movie. I like the optimism of this movie. I just didn't care for it in practice and was really frustrated by it. And I wasn't necessarily frustrated by it in a this is a gigantic boondoggle sort of way. I just kept wanting to like it more. Mm. And it just never took off. It has these moments, these visually dazzling moments. It keeps teasing you with visions of this incredible Tomorrowland future, and you see like people diving into swimming pools and
that's
out
really
the
cool
bottom
visual.
And into yeah. another
that's
swimming
cool
pool
visual.
And out the bottom.
I like that a lot.
And I just wanted to be, I felt like that was the fireworks factory, and the movie kept taking me away from the fireworks factory. It kept pulling you back into this kind of earthbound place that I just didn't find as interesting. I kind of wanted the movie to take off more.
Yeah, it was an earthbound place that you could easily replicate for a theme park, which I kept on thinking, oh my God, that sequence in the movie memorabilia sequence.
Oh, yeah.
It's as if they have built a theme park attraction and you're supposed to go to it, or the house mm-hmm. where all these doors come down and things start electrocuting
people. I love that
sequence,
and too. I thought that sequence was is kind of almost slightly steampunky.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Influenced
there's
in some ways, I think.
The booby-trapped house.
Yeah, the booby-trapped house, and also all the goggles. And the, I mean, steampunk is all about the goggles. And you know, I know that because steampunk people told me so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. Like, I think the critical take on this movie has largely been exactly what you guys have said. Somewhere between B- and C-, you know, from I would say, most of the people whose reviews I have seen. I really like this movie. I will say this first. I got all the way through this movie. I did not know Damon Lindelof had co-written the script. Got to the end, and I was thinking, see, I kind of go for, like, the grand thing this movie is trying to do with kind of big feelings and big ideas about the importance of people coming together and all this stuff. So I'm sitting there, and the credits come up, and it says, co-written by Brad Bird and Damon Lindelof. And I went, oh, of course it is, because I am the same way about the stuff he did in Lost. And frankly, I was the same way about Prometheus. I was more pro on Prometheus than most people were. He does a thing where he is endlessly fascinated by trying to use science fiction style stories to talk about really fundamental human things, like the sanctity of one person trying to help another person. A lot of that is what Lost is, self-sacrifice and community and building relationships with other people. I am always much more susceptible to that than most people are, and much less bothered by the fact that pretty consistently, he'll give you a movie that is like a sweater with a bunch of threads hanging off. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like you kind of have to love it for the kind of unfinished, uneven thing that it is if you're going to love it at all.
Oh, but and there's so much that this movie doesn't answer. Like, there are so many of those threads. Like, what motivates the bad guys is never answered.
Okay, but here's the other thing. The fundamental point of this movie, I don't think it's a terrible spoiler to say this, but, like, what this movie is getting at, as these guys have alluded to a little bit, is a play between optimism and pessimism. But it's not optimism as just be a dreamer, be happy, feel great all the time. It's an idea of optimism as a motivator for action. And one of its knocks on cynicism that I really appreciated is bringing out the idea that cynicism is lazy and that people become cynics and skeptics in part because, as a character says in the movie at one time, it doesn't ask anything of you. And I agree with that. And I think the movie agrees with it. And one of the things that's fascinating to me about this movie and one of the things I like about it is that it has this big, thundering Hugh Laurie monologue.
Villain monologue.
Villain monologue.
From a guy who wrote The Incredibles, which has a running gag about how villains always monologue.
No, I know. Okay, but there's this big villain monologue. But I think the movie agrees with about 96% of the villain monologue.
Oh, yeah.
So I think it's always, you always get more interesting villains when the villains spend a lot of time saying something that your movie basically agrees with. There's a little bit of that in Age of Ultron, to be honest.
Oh, yeah.
There's a little bit of it in Die Hard. You know, you get a lot of villains who say things that make a certain amount of sense, but this is the first one I can remember where the villain basically gives the worldview of the movie.
Yeah.
And in a very direct way. And I liked that about it. And I like the performances. I did not have the same sense that you did, that they were all in different movies. I think that Raffi Cassidy performance is terrific. I think she's doing exactly what she's supposed to be doing. She's in a Disney movie, and she's doing what she's supposed to be doing in a Disney movie. I like all that steampunky mad scientist stuff. I really appreciate it. It is weirdly paced. It seemed to kind of speed up and slow down in a weird way. It's kind of like gluggy. You can't really figure out where the act breaks are. Mm-hmm. Not that necessarily that's important in a movie, but in a movie that has as many conventional pieces as this one does, I was surprised it didn't have a more discernible kind of three-act structure. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I appreciate a big swing. They are both people who sometimes do not execute perfectly, and I think the best hope here would have been that Brad Bird is more of an exacting guy on execution, and I don't think that that necessarily happened that way. Mm-hmm. But I love, like, with the Lindelovian stuff, I love the fact that he has this chronic desire to bite off wildly more than he can chew. Right. I sort of like that about him.
Linda loves Lindelof. Good.
And I'm sorry if this is me kind of buying into the premise of the movie, but, like, I want there to be people where that's their thing. Their thing is, mm-hmm. like, I'm going to try to make a big, grand, important movie about the importance of getting off your behind and trying to fix the world. Like, I think that's audacious for a summer movie.
In a way, it's almost Wachowski-esque, though. Like,
it is.
Like, you want people to be making gigantically ambitious, big-budget movies that run the risk of not being very good.
And I'm not suggesting that the people who don't like this movie don't like ambition or are lacking in some way in how they're taking it in. This is just how I reacted to it.
It is a product of pure, intense, I would say abject sincerity. There's no getting around that. It is a plea for optimism, as you say, versus cynicism. But this monologue that we've talked about, we've touched on, that Hugh Laurie basically stops the film dead
yep.
for almost 3-4 minutes of screen time to deliver what is essentially a really preachy TED talk directly past the characters in the room to the audience. I mean, can I have cynicisms back here for a second? Dreamers are great. Optimists are great. You can invite all the great thinkers and artists and ballerinas and GE car engineers to a big society, but that's a brainstorming meeting. That's not a society. You need cynics. Cynics get stuff done. Cynics are pragmatists.
I think there is also the point that is made in the movie that cynics also often sit back and say, like, well, what's the point?
Yeah.
Like, what's the point of doing it?
That came through.
What's the point of doing it? But I think that is true. I think that is often true. It's not always true. When I watch that and when Hugh Laurie gives his big speech about, like, what's happening in the world and what's not happening in the world, I agree with all of that. I was like, yup. When he's sort of saying, like, does it not seem insane to you? I was sitting in the movie like, yes, it does, Hugh Laurie. Cough it up, villain. I am here for this speech.
I am very rarely in a position of wanting to like better a $150 million picture. I mean, it just doesn't happen very often for me. And I when I go to them, I expect them to be really wonderful. I felt guilty about the way I felt about this. And it's actually nice to hear you saying how much you liked it, because I wanted desperately to like this picture. And I especially wanted to like it once I understood what it was all about, what it was saying, because I agree with all that. I didn't like to be lectured. I felt like I was being lectured.
I mean, the thing with that speech, it actually reminds me a little bit of when I watch stuff that Aaron Sorkin writes, where Aaron Sorkin...
that is so low.
No. You like a lot of Aaron Sorkin's work.
I do. And for some of the same reasons.
But Aaron Sorkin is stricken with the disease of thinking that all the world's problems need is a good Stern lecture. Mm-hmm. If the world's bad guys just heard the right Stern lecture, then they wouldn't be so misguided. And this movie kind of views optimism the same way. It's like optimism is this tangible product that, if expressed, has weight and strength. And it's a very simplistic view of optimism. It really has this kind of, like, as soon as she expresses a note of optimism, like, the world's odds improve.
Well, but that's metaphorical. I mean, be fair to the movie. Like, that is metaphorical in the sense that, like, yes, that is what the movie is saying.
But there is a moment in which that literally happens.
Right, I know. I'm saying it's metaphorical in the movie. It literally happens in the movie. It's a metaphor, Stephen.
Can we talk about retrofuturism for a second? The aesthetic of this film.
Absolutely.
I love the aesthetic. I love the visual aesthetic of this film. We now call it retrofuturism, but it kind of came about in the 20s, 30s, and 40s and 50s as just futurism. But it's this weird thing, you know. At the same time that this kind of futurism was arising, with the jetpacks and the space age stuff and all that stuff, there was also this neo-socialist futurism, this idea, the Diego Rivera mural, the socialist paradise. And this always feels to me much more Eisenhower ideals. It's,
sure.
It's talking about progress, but it's not remotely progressive. It's taking the values of the Eisenhower era and transposing them 100, 200 years in the future. Because what changes, really, in a lot of these things you've seen that are retrofuturism? Your commute, because you've got jetpacks and flying cars, and housework. It's all about gadgets that make the housewife's life easier.
It's all convenience.
It is all convenience. It is a very white, suburban, middle-class idea of the future. And even though they've gone out of their way to make, just to show this future as being diverse, it's a cosmetic diversity, because the core of this is still that white, middle-class, suburban, I like Ike ideal that kind of feels a little, it looks great, but there's something, well, retro.
Well, right, but you're basically basing your entire idea of what, like how this movie sees the future on the Jetsons.
Well, no, this movie is basing on that. See, my problem is that in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and you know, you just take what you see in front of you and you put it into the future. Here you're taking this idea of what the future liked in 1950 and saying, this is what I want. This idea of the meritocracy of we'll be led by brilliant thinkers. It just feels, it's something sinister in it.
I've just realized I have something to contribute to this conversation that I didn't think about before. I'm the only one here who's old enough to have been at the 1964 World's Fair. Mm-hmm. That's where this movie starts.
Right.
It starts at the World's Fair, and it begins with this idea of what that thought was going to be the future. Among the many futuristic things that I did at the World's Fair was to place a phone call where I could see my grandmother in the Bronx. This was astonishing, I mean, that they could do this at the time. So they got a couple of things right about what the future was going to be like and that convenience you were talking about. A lot of the things that were predicted in that had to do with just driving cars through dinosaurs and things like that.
Sure.
I guess it's envisioning Jurassic Park. The world that they were predicting back then was very much clean and pretty and all the things that we now think are terribly important but that we have not achieved, right? That that we look around and we don't have that except in shopping malls. And it made sense to me that a lot of this picture looked like an airport or a shopping mall, that it looked like it was taking place in those places. And I think that this is, I think the thing that the picture does best is the visualizing of what we think the future is going to be like. The retro future, there's a moment in this where it shows you what we thought the future was like prior to the 1960s.
The Jules Verne-like one.
Yeah. And that is still really appealing in the way we picture things. And I enjoy looking at visions of the 1800s vision of the future almost more than I do looking at what we think the future is going to be like now.
Right.
Yeah.
This is a one version of one of five different kind of categories of,
heavens.
Of the future.
Here we go.
This is the utopia version. This is the it gets better version that Star Trek is also belongs to. This is like humanity gets its crap together and we go out into the stars or we do something and we bring our noblest self out into the cosmos. But the other four that I could come up with, which is your basic nuclear war, post-apocalyptic nuclear war, wasteland, Mad Max kind of thing, which we're seeing less of now. The Mad Max is kind of an outlier because we've switched over to the environmental disaster now. That's much bigger. There's also the virus/zombie apocalypse. And finally, there's the rise of the machine apocalypse. So those four, what they have in common is it's our fault. Yeah. We did something wrong. I mean, there are outliers like the environmental disaster. Sometimes it's a comet that just, or an asteroid that we don't have anything. But
or an
now,
earthquake.
This week, earthquake, which you don't have much to do about. But mostly those, in recent years, those environmental disaster ones are, it's all our fault. Because these are, as you said, metaphors. These are morality plays, basically. And we're implicated in the fate of humanity because we're part of it and we're doing something wrong. That's what most of these
But we
negative...
are implicated in the fate of humanity. Like, that's not even a question.
No,
like,
of course.
I mean,
and what these films tend to do, the post-apocalyptic films tend to do, is just remind me how, you know what I'm not, is hard bitten. You know what I won't be able to function in? The apocalypse. Because I am soft and gummy. And, you know, I just can't, like, if the Apple TV seizes up, I go fetal. So this is not, it's just
the, you're the first one gone.
I think there's going to be, we should see a film sometime when a lot of the population just kind of removes itself from the equation once the apocalypse happens.
I suppose. How about you, Stephen? What's your vision of future in movies or books or whatever?
Yeah, I am really, really partial to near future imaginative speculative fiction. And two examples that jumped right out at me. One was Her, which we've talked about on this show before, but which imagines a fairly near future by extrapolating elements of the present. And that includes, obviously, the central plot of the movie where, you know, we've programmed interactive computers to the point where they can have human emotions. But also, like, little subtle touches in that movie, like just anticipating fashion trends. The whole bit with the high-waisted pants. I love and am really partial to that kind of granular look at a kind of near future. And the other one that I bring up in the same way that I just love is Minority Report. Mm-hmm. And the way that Minority Report, which gets a lot of things right, you know, I mean, obviously there's all that stuff with the big brain in the pod or whatever, sure. You know, the precog, whatever. Mm-hmm. But a lot of its view of day-to-day life in the future is, I think, very prescient. And the way that the Tom Cruise character is walking through the world, just being bombarded with advertising that can read who he is and respond to who he is, that kind of commentary on the future, that kind of look at the future that has relevance to the present and isn't just this far away in the future there are flying cars. I'm much more interested in intrusive advertising than mm-hmm. I am in flying cars.
Mm-hmm. Sure. No, that makes sense. That makes sense. I think about a lot of these movies, and particularly a lot of the dystopian stuff that Glenn has been talking about, whether it comes in the form of the environmental disaster or the plague or whatever. I think one of the things that always bothers me about those movies is that they do tend to continue what Tomorrowland would see as a cynical idea of kind of letting everybody else off the hook. Everybody else sits around and waits for the one person yeah. in the future to save everyone, whether it's, you know, Katniss Everdeen or whether it's the dude in Elysium that Matt Damon played or whoever it is, one person. And I guess what I respond to about this movie that is kind of related to all these other visions of the future and where I get back to kind of like my Linda Lovian weak spot is he is always fascinated by the idea of the greatest power being people acting in concert. Mm. And so to me, this entire movie is really pointing at the importance of even if you have one great person who's very brave and works very hard, their fundamental value is in persuading other people to act in concert and mm-hmm. kind of harnessing the power of other people acting humanely and together. And that's like, I understand that that is kind of a cornball. Sure. It's cornball and it's messagey and there's Hugh Laurie in a robe. I get it.
Well, here's my theory about pop culture visions of the future and also of the past, which we're going to talk about next. It seems to me that making that jump, either forward or back, when you tell stories, you are removing the ambiguity and the ambivalence that we all feel here in the present for this idealized, or the opposite of idealized in the case of the apocalypse, this other existence where the choices are much more stark and simple and clean. So you, in the past, we always go, when people want to talk about how things were in the past, they tend to think about it as it was simpler time, people had their roles. That's a lot of those stories. In the future, whether it's, you know, you have to spend against yourself against the zombies or whatever the future is, it's, again, simpler, less complicated. We're not in this cloud of shady morality, which is why I like the science fiction that preserves some of that in the future. Like writers like Anne Leckie and China Mieville are thinking about how does language evolve? What happens to gender roles in the future? It doesn't reduce it to this black and white kind of thing. It keeps that essential complexity even in a genre piece.
All right. Well, I give myself the last word, and the last word is I cried at the end. Yay! All right. I will be interested to hear if there's anyone left who has not expressed an opinion about this movie who has seen it. I'll be interested to hear what all of you think. So find us on Facebook or on Twitter or on the blog and let us know. All right. When we come back, we are going to talk about pop culture visions of the past. So hang around for that.
This is Nick from Port St. Lucie, Florida, and this episode and the following message are made possible by PicMonkey.com, an online photo editor that is super sorry for being a promotional message right now. What they want to be is your favorite photo editor. Whether you're editing photos or creating collages, you'll be having fun and making cool stuff. And now you, yes you, can have a free month of PicMonkey's premium subscription. It's a heaping mega spoon of bonus features, and it costs money for everybody except you. Just go to picmonkey.com/pop.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Before the break, we were talking about pop culture visions of the future. Now we are going to shift gears, but just barely, and talk about pop culture visions of the past. Now, when I was talking about this topic earlier today with Bob Mondello, I said to him, you know, Bob, this is one of my questions. Are we any less in a world of fantasy when we talk about our visions of the past than when we talk about our visions of the future? Thank you for that interested murmur.
Yes. Go on.
You don't say.
I appreciate that interested murmur. All right, Bob, since you were the person that I shared this wackadoo question with, do you have thoughts about it?
Well, the very first thing I said when you asked that this afternoon was, well, yeah, of course, it's Downton Abbey. I mean, life is like Downton Abbey, isn't it? What Glenn was just saying earlier about the simplification of things is absolutely there. Everything is sort of laid out in a very neat and clear way. The social interactions between people are rigidly controlled by culture. I can't imagine that was ever true, except in a very rarefied section of society.
Wow.
And so, you know, as a practical matter, I think we do. We simplify things in the past. We make them one of the favorite things that people do when they're taking Shakespeare these days is to put it in modern dress, because that lets you see that things back then were kind of exactly the same, but
right.
It allows you to see it in a way that you might not otherwise, because, well, they were wearing funny clothes, so
right.
they must have been different in some way.
Right. No, absolutely. And I think it's funny that you bring up Downton Abbey, because one of the things that I was thinking about is, we just talked last week about the end of Mad Men, and I think Downton and Mad Men get a lot of their dramatic tension from the same place, which is the use of a setting in the past to impose a lot of restrictions on people and to create a lot of tension simply in the social expectations, which we presume were a lot greater at that time. And both of those shows get a lot of juice from that. But I wonder whether in 100 years, people with more perspective will recognize roles that were just as rigid and expectations that could be just as confining for people in the world that we have now. Because the other thing that I was admitting to somebody the other day, when I used to watch Mad Men, I used to sit there and think, like, I get why people liked it when roles were clearer. Like, I get that people, that if you were born a woman into a certain family, you only had a couple choices. You know, I get why that appealed to some people, that marriages worked a certain way and whatever.
These are the stories we tell ourselves, and we tell ourselves this for a reason. We're commenting on today when we're saying this is what the past was like. I'm not necessarily a fan of historical drama writ large, because there's always that, you know, Merchant Ivory, golden light, everything's very beautiful and soft focus, everybody looks great. In 1995, there was a film called Persuasion, based on the Jane Austen novel, where they went out of their way to make sure that nobody wore makeup, they didn't have any hair products, they had terrible teeth, bad skin, and their clothes were ratty, and it just felt like a revelation. It felt fantastic. It starred Amanda Root, and it was just, there's a flatness to how it was filmed. It was just an insight into, okay, this is probably closer to what was actually, to what it was actually like. You could smell the halitosis in the room at every dinner scene. It was awesome. There was a writer at the turn of the 20th century called Thomas Nelson Page, who lived here in D.C., and he was famous for what were then called plantation novels. He was a guy who wrote these stories from the point of view of ex-slaves, harking back to the antebellum South, harking back to how wonderful it was back on the old plantation. And I had to read a few of these novels for a project a while back. And it's just like reading evil. You're reading somebody who's writing this because he wants to challenge the slave narratives of Frederick Douglass and Uncle Tom's Cabin. And he defends lynching several points there. And it's just because you need to tell yourself, this is what it is about. It's about you tell yourself that your understanding of the present is correct by casting this idea of the past that you assert when you write about the past.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's one reason that I'm interested in looks at the past that take what appears to be a simpler time and just muddies it up. I mean, that's one thing that's appealing about Mad Men, right? Is Mad Men has these, you know, yes, people are stuffed into rigid roles and you have this very, very specific look, and the look of the show does a lot of the work, but you're still just constantly muddying the moral waters of it. And so, like, you know, looking at a whole genre of movies that is largely set in the past, like Westerns, it's one reason that I'm so drawn to a movie like Unforgiven. which seems to be setting up a certain black hat, white hat battle. And there is an element of that. But the white hat is constantly compromised. And I think that's just a wonderful movie, in part because it's not idealizing the past in any way. It's not idealizing the West in any way. It's taking these stories and understanding that things are just as complicated in this world as they are in the now world, as they no doubt will be in the future world.
It's funny when we talk about these really great productions, and Glenn brings up one with the undone hair and the ratty clothes, because one of the things that always occurs to me is one reason why people like period pieces is that because you're already living in a completely separate world, people inherently expect to see the best of the clothes, mm-hmm. the best of the hair, just because otherwise, why are we here? So I think it kind of frees up. I've talked a bunch of times on this show about Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries, mm-hmm. The wonderful, wonderful Australian television show. Half of the reason to watch this show is the amazing costuming that goes on and how great it is to just see. I mean, you think they have pretty clothes on Downton Abbey. You have seen nothing until you see some of what Phryne Fisher wears on Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries. And so to me, you know, you see these period pieces and I do always want to, like, I want to see great clothes. I'm not going to lie. Like, I get the verite thing that Glenn is talking about in terms of they wouldn't really have all worn great clothes all the time. But I want to see the great clothes.
Well, trust me, you're not alone. I got to sit at Arena Stage. They were doing one of those, they call it Giselle chambers, where they have people sitting behind a mirror. And the people in the room don't realize that, or actually probably do realize that there's somebody back there, but they can't see.
Oh, I see.
Us. And so I was sitting on the other side. I was on the side with the Arena Stage folks. They were talking about what attracts people to subscribe to Arena Stage. Now, this is one of our great regional theaters and everything.
Sure.
And I wanted them to be talking about the quality of the plays and the writing and the acting and all that. And they were all talking about the costumes.
Yeah.
And it was driving me nuts. Mm-hmm. But it was clear that there's a reason they spend a fortune at Shakespeare productions on elaborate sets and costumes.
Right.
Audiences love that stuff. And it is much of the attraction of the good old days in films and things like that. You can't watch any picture that's about the 50s or 60s without thinking about what it looks like and whether it's accurate.
Right. And it's fascinating to see stuff like FX has The Americans, which is a show set in the 1980s. And to my knowledge, it's the first kind of unironic period piece mm-hmm. about the 80s mm-hmm. that I can think of that's worked quite that way, where the aesthetic of the 1980s, which is often written off as a very kind of kitsch-driven,
garish,
mm-hmm. you know, leg warmers and stuff like that, it has its own quality that adds something to that show, and it's not treated in that kind of over-the-top way, which I think you have to wait until some of the people who were teenagers in the 80s have outgrown being the people who run everything.
Yeah. But very smartly, the designers of that show and the designers on Mad Men knew that they're not going to, like, put somebody in a dress that came out that year,
yeah.
that people mm-hmm. reuse dresses and their furniture was from 20 years ago,
right.
20 years before the show starts,
right.
because that's the way people don't buy furniture every year.
Right.
So it can't be this false, perfect,
in the moment
thing. It has to just it has to bleed a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and you also want to get some little detail that you don't just see in every production of that era. You know, you mentioned leg warmers. Like, if you can get a detail of the 80s that isn't in everything else. Like, Bob, I remember we talked about the movie The Tree of Life on this mm-hmm. show mm-hmm. whenever it was nominated for an Oscar. And there's that scene in the movie where the DDT
spray, and the kids are running to play in the cloud of DDT.
Yeah, the truck is going through and spraying DDT,
right.
and the kids are playing in it.
And today you go, ah! Oh, my
right.
God, they're all going to die.
Of course.
But at the time, I remember those trucks.
Yeah.
And I remember you saying, like, that had conjured a very specific mm-hmm. memory of that era, and that is not a memory of the era that anyone else has from the loops
right.
of nostalgia that look back to that
right.
era.
Mm-hmm.
That they managed to find something that was specific
right.
to that era that hadn't been recycled endlessly.
Mm-hmm. It's not the poodle skirts and the jukeboxes
yeah.
and all that
right.
stuff. It's funny because the power that artifacts and things and the look of things have to transport you in a movie comes from the way they are in life. I mean, I recently came into possession of a wristwatch that had belonged to my late grandfather, and who I never met. I found myself kind of looking at it saying, like, well, this would have been from no later than this year, because that's when he was alive, and trying to kind of look at it thinking about, like, well, it doesn't have a crystal on it anymore, but mm-hmm. looking at it thinking, like, how this did and didn't look like watches now. And it really is interesting to hold something like that in mm-hmm. your hands. And I think, as far as I know, it's not a suit. It's a watch that a regular guy wore. And it doesn't have to have anything special about it, even though I like to see the special clothes on television. Mm-hmm. Even those ordinary objects are very transporting in real life, and I think can be when they're used properly on television as well. It's interesting that you brought – that we talked a little bit about the Jetsons, because, of course, the Jetsons and the Flintstones mm-hmm. are exactly. pretty much the same show. Mm-hmm. It is – caring about both the future and the past in terms of how would this different setting affect, like, my little day-to-day.
Exactly. Like, just importing it.
Just mm-hmm. It's just importing it. And so on the Jetsons, there's a little special thing that you use to send the kid off to school. On the Flintstones, there's the little bird that runs the record player mm-hmm. with the beak. And I'm not trying to be like, I'm not going for veracity of the Flintstones. That is not my, that is not what I'm saying. But the comedy of the Flintstones came from importing stuff like drive-in movies, mm-hmm. that they would go to drive-in movies, only it was a drive-in movie where, you know, it was a horn of a giant animal that was the speaker.
And it's a living.
And it's true. You know, and kind of the whole idea of even driving a car is sort of, it's just like us, except a little different.
Exactly. You take the social values you have in that moment and right. say, let's change the trappings, but not right. change the relationships.
Which is why you can tell the difference between a thing about the prehistoric era that's made in the 60s versus the 70s versus the 80s, mm-hmm. you know, versus now. It's not like you can't tell.
Right.
And it's not like Mad Men is not a creature of the 2000s, mm-hmm. you know, because it totally is. All right. Well, I will be, again, interested to hear what some of you have to say about depictions of the past. And so come and find us on Facebook or find us on Twitter. We are at NPRPCHH. And when we come back, we will have our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. When does learning begin? Are we at the end of privacy? And what does the road from curiosity to discovery look like? The TED Radio Hour is a journey through fascinating ideas, astonishing inventions, fresh approaches to old problems, and new ways to think and create. Find the TED Radio Hour podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, sir?
A few weeks ago, I recommended a graphic novel called Roller Girl.
Yep.
It is wonderful. I've already talked about it. One of the things that I was excited about with Roller Girl, which my 11-year-old daughter loved, mm-hmm. is that I felt like it was a gateway drug to finally sit down with her and watch Whip It. Drew Barrymore directed. It's a coming-of-age story. It's Ellen Page and a whole bunch
Kristen Wiig
and a whole bunch of Eve is in it. A whole bunch of really fun actresses are in it. We've talked about it on this show before. It is a terrific coming-of-age movie if you have not seen it. Kind of in a way in anticipation of going to Inside Out with her. Mm-hmm. I sat down with my daughter and watched Whip It. And, you know, you and I, Linda, have talked before about the fact that she is a contrarian and somebody, and you warned me about Inside Out. You were like, just to warn you, you know she's gonna pretend she hates it. Right. She did not do that with Whip It. She unabashedly, not only did she love it, and not only was she like talking about it giddily and talking about roller derby and being excited about how the movie shows you a little bit more of the mechanics of roller derby, which is now increasingly fascinating to her. Mm-hmm. The next morning, I got up and rubbed the sleep out of my eyes and trudged downstairs. I overhear she has slipped downstairs at 7 o'clock in the morning to watch Whip It again.
There you go.
So a little parenting success. If you have a scrappy, troublemaking 11-year-old at home, I think that child is ready for whipping.
We talked about that when we first saw that movie. We talked about when she would be ready to see it.
And that movie came out in 2009. Mm-hmm. I have been waiting to show her that movie for 6 years now, and it finally happened. And the fact that it was somehow, like, it was just as strong an experience for her and hopefully as formative an experience for her as it has been is making me delighted this week.
Awesome.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Movie night with kids is always a win. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Two things. The first is The Allusionist, A-L-L-usionist, is a podcast by comedian Helen Zaltzman, British comedian Helen Zaltzman, in which she unpacks various aspects of the English language. And she does it in a very pithy 13 to 15 minutes, and then she's out. Comes out every 2 weeks. I would recommend starting with either the first one, which is about puns, or the one that's about the C word. She's great. It's great. It's a lot of fun. The other thing is we mentioned in passing last week an actor by the name of Flula Borg.
We did.
Flula Borg is a German actor and DJ and also turns out a YouTube star. Now, I have a giant blind spot when it comes to the whole universe of YouTube stars, because I don't know. I could probably figure he was a German DJ because all Germans are DJs.
that is not true.
Most Germans are DJs. He has, his YouTube show is called What's a Flula? And for what he does is he recaps various things, or at least he has been doing this for a while. A couple years ago, he was recapping episodes of season 3 of Game of Thrones. And so what he does is it's just him in his bedroom staring at the camera, giant face, and then it cuts away as he's recapping the show, to animation. So you have to imagine the animation that comes in. So if you are 2 years behind in your Game of Thrones, there's a big spoiler here, so deal with it, or just skip ahead about a minute. But Jessica, hit me one time.
It is a good time. Everyone enjoy, enjoy. And then, smack, smack, stab, poke. Everybody is dead. The frost killed so many people, they even killed two people who are not on the show, you know? Hello, guys. It's Jerry Seinfeld. What's the deal with stab? Hey, it's Alf. I brought some cat pie. Dead. Stab. Hi, guys. It's me, Michael Keaton. I was the first Batman in 19. Chop, stab. Hello, Froze. It's Thomas Edison. I brought some light. It's a bulb. Stab, dead, stab, slice. Hello, guys. It is me, Edward James Olmos. The star of Battlestar Galactica stabbed.
The star of Battlestar Galactica. It sounds like a bit, right? It sounds like he's doing a bit. He's not doing a bit. That is Flula Borg. What's a Flula?
That is amazing. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Bob Mondello, what is making you happy this week?
Well, what's really making me happy is that I've already seen Aloha, so I don't have to see it again. The new Cameron Crowe
Ouch.
Movie.
Ouch.
But there is a movie that's opening next week that you and I saw in Toronto
that we did.
Really, really liked. It was one, I think it might even have been the very first thing
it
we saw when
we
got there. It's called Charlie's Country. Mm-hmm. It is about an Aboriginal guy named Charlie in Australia who is on what amounts to a reservation. He is a hunter, and they're not letting him hunt.
G'day, look.
G'day, Charlie.
You white bastard.
You black bastard.
You got a license?
License? We're not going to drive you. We're just going to shoot him.
What do you got there?
I made a spear. Hunting spear.
Wow. It's a dangerous weapon. I'm going to have to destroy it.
And it's really not much more complicated than that. It is just a ravishingly gorgeous, interesting, fascinating character portrait. And the guy, David Gulpilili, did I say that right?
I think that's
David
right.
David Gulpilili is absolutely extraordinary and ought to win every award given next year.
It's a great movie.
It's just a beautiful picture.
I'm really glad it's coming out. We loved that movie. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Bob Mondello. All right, I got a couple things. One that Glenn might be familiar with. There was another really lovely Judge John Hodgman podcast last week with a man who did not want to celebrate the birthdays of his children, particularly currently his 4-year-old daughter. He just doesn't like birthdays. He has all these feelings about why birthdays are stupid.
Uh-huh.
And you'd be surprised what a really, really lovely and insightful and compassionate and yet firm case this turns out to be. So that's
Agreed.
One thing. Another thing, people ask me frequently to remind them of some of the contemporary romance novel writers that I have talked about in the past that I like. Two of them have new books out either this week or next week. Shannon Stacey, that's Shannon Stacey, S-T-A-C-E-Y, has a new book out called Under the Lights, which is the beginning of a new series of hers. Hooray for a new series. And Julie James, who I have talked about on the show a couple times, who is a woman who used to be a lawyer, so hooray for that also, has a new one out called Suddenly One Summer, which is the next in a series that she has been writing. So those two things. My third thing, which I was fortunately reminded of by our pal Tara Ariano on Twitter, is the Tumblr pattern behavior, which is found at McCall's Pattern Behavior, and that is McCall's, the sewing company, M-C-C-A-L-L-S, patternbehavior.tumblr.com. And this is essentially the illustrations from the front of dress patterns from the 1940s and 50s when women did a lot more sewing at home, made their own dresses, captioning just funny captions on the illustrations on the front of women's dress patterns. So in one of these Tumblr posts, for example, it's a pattern clearly for a house coat, which is like the thing that a lady would wear that is a robe but not a robe. Mm-hmm. And looks more like a dress. And there's two.
Thank you for explaining to me what a house coat is.
There's two just like regular ladies in house coats. And then there's one in a house coat with a hood. And then the two ladies are kind of looking at the one in the hood. And the caption under it just says, "Swag hood, Joyce." And they're all just these very, very silly. It's one of those things that's extremely hard to explain on a podcast. But if you go look at McCallsPatternBehavior.tumblr.com, and that is by Natalie Kosar, you will not be sorry. They are really funny and really wonderful, and it's one of my current favorite Tumblrs. So that is what is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon and Bob at Bob_Mondello. You can follow our producer Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy. That's R-E-E-D-Y. And our producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. And as I mentioned earlier, you can follow the show at NPR PCHH. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you're tapping your foot to right now. So thank you to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Great.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.